So if you are offering your gift at the altar, and there remember that, here it says your brother, I tend to say that one born from the same womb as you has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go. First be reconciled to the one born from the same womb as you, and then come and offer your gift. Make friends quickly with your accuser while you are going with that one to the court, lest your accuser hand you over to the judge, and the judge to the guard, and you be put in prison. Truly I say to you, you will never get out till you have paid the last penny. Well, that's the coming clean part for me. I'm not nearly as whimsical as you are. I continue when you speak to be drawn in. It's like good sermons, and it's really a tremendous gift. And I'm not nearly that whimsical. But what I'd like to do is to come clean, kind of from the beginning, about at least one portion of how I go about doing things. Sometimes that's called method, I guess. At least how I go about doing lots of things with my Christian faith, not just the issue of, or the area of Jewish-Christian dialogue, or how I think in that area. But so my first coming clean is, your method is kind of storytelling, and my method is more like the confessional. Lutherans have given up the confessional for all practical purposes, even though Luther kept encouraging people not to do that. He thought that was not. So my method is more like that, and the coming clean is part of that. The G are the givens. The givens of my Christian faith, the givens in the Scripture, the given Bible verses, the given interpretations of those Bible verses, the ones I grow up with, the ones I presently have, kind of all the givens. And what part of coming clean for me is to take the givens, all my own givens, and turn them into problems. That's the P. And then to take givens, make givens into problems, is all for the sake of that little arrow going up is represent better S's, solutions. Not final solutions. As we'll find out, that's not a happy word in Jewish Christian dialogue, the word's final solutions, but better solutions. So that's part of coming clean. So that's one of the things that I hope to do today a little bit, is just let you know a little bit about how that has happened with me over this issue of Jewish-Christian relationships. Givens, taking givens, turning them into problems for the sake of discovering better solutions, or more godly solutions, you might say. Well,
G2. Can you be more specific about that?
Mm-hmm.
What the givens are and what the
mm-hmm.
problems are?
Hopefully that'll start to come out a little bit, but what I want to let you know is kind of how I go about doing this. It's not a happy way to go about doing things necessarily, because it takes all the givens of my life and says, make them into a problem. In other words, search them out. Look at them a little closer. Treat them as if they're not just that's the way it has to be, but treat them more as a problem to wrestle with. So it can be applied to all kinds of things. Like it can be applied, one example would be John 3:16. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believes in him should not perish but have eternal life. You could say, okay, that's a given, and we all know what that is, and often we say that's the gospel in a nutshell. But what about that word for? That's a tough one. But how about the word so? For God so loved the world. I guess I've always thought that means, for God loved the world so much that he gave. But I don't think that, after turning that one into a problem for a while, I think I discovered that what that means is, for God loved the world just so, not so much, but just so, colon, he gave his only begotten Son. You did that this morning. You said you took a given will or plan and you turned it into a problem to try to discover a more godly understanding of that word, anakaphalaphosis. to recapitulate. Well, that's kind of what I'm going to try to do today, and that's, I think, what's been, I think when you enter into the Jewish-Christian dialogue, one of people, or lots of things, why do this? Why talk about Jewish-Christian dialogues? How many people know Jews or have a daily relationship with them, or religious Jews or Judaism? And frankly, not much, which is not many, which is why I read the Matthew passage where it says, if when you bring your gift to the altar, you suddenly remember that someone of the same womb as you has a grievance against you. Notice it says, you don't remember that you have something against somebody else, but that somebody else, one born from the same womb as you, has a grievance against you. Then leave your gift at the altar and go and reconcile yourself quickly. So it's the motivation to moving out to, if you follow this saying of the Lord's recorded in Matthew, the motivation for moving out into a relationship with somebody is not, it's on your part. They may have a grievance with you, and it's up to you to search that out. Well, that's part of it. 1967. Let's keep moving on. Otherwise, we get bogged down. I'm going to skip G2, P4 for a while. Maybe at the end we'll talk about that. 1967. 1 week from now, in 1967, so in June 1967, think about for a moment what you were up to, what you were doing. Where were you? What was going through your mind? Has anybody got any? May take a few seconds to search your memory. You got one. What?
My husband just graduated. We were celebrating graduation.
So. Is that a high time for you?
Yeah, very high time. Very exciting.
How about other people? Yeah.
I was in between my junior and sophomore year in high school, and
did you start in the first week of June, by any chance?
I don't know yet.
I used to pick pickles too in high school. Get all green hands and sore back, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You must be from, where are you from? The Midwest?
Yeah.
Wisconsin. I was working in a cheese factory.
Working in a cheese factory. How about other people?
The war in Vietnam was going on, and I had a boyfriend. Well, he graduated in June of 67, and he went in, was just getting ready to go in July.
So you were really saying goodbye?
Uh-huh.
Did he come back?
Uh-huh. I was a maverick.
You were what?
I was a maverick.
You were a maverick already at Hoagland.
I was just starting driver's education.
Starting driver's ed. Did you do that in the first week? Can you can you narrow it down to the first week in June? What you were doing in the first week of June? Is today the June 1st?
Yes.
Yeah. What you were doing the first week of June, 67, 1967.
Summer
school started. So you may have started. You may have been learning to drive a stick on June 5th.
I think I was just getting out of school. The kid, you know, I was teaching.
Oh yeah. Okay. Okay, to open it up just a little bit, think, well, you had kind of a global remembrance. Do you have any, let me tell you what I was thinking, first of all. In June of 67, that was the year that I discovered that, I was in high school, that was end of my junior year, somebody said, between sophomore, and I was a pitcher all spring long, and in high school baseball, and I threw all through curveballs, and I could barely lift my arm, so sore. So I decided that I better give up becoming a major league baseball player, which I wasn't close to, and start taking up tennis more seriously. So that's what I was up to. And so I remember that really well because I really had a sore shoulder in the month of June in 67. And I made a conscious decision at that point to quit playing baseball and take up tennis. And so to this day, tennis is a big thing for me. How about global events, 67? Can you think of anything? June 67.
War.
Which war? The Six-Day War. Every I suppose that's where I'm moving towards. Every serious Jew, either Christian, either religious or secular, that's conscious or reflective about their Jewishness, whether that be defined religiously or, as some people call, secularized, secularly. If you said, what were they doing in June, or June 1st, or June 5th of 1967, they know right off the bat. They were remembering. Because June 5th to June 10th was the Six Day War. And what they were remembering was the Holocaust and Hitler. Because June 67 was the verge of giving Hitler what people call, I always have trouble saying this word, a posthumous, is that how you say it? Posthumous victory, a victory after his death. Because Israel was on the verge of extinction again. And I can vaguely remember, I do have a vague remember of hearing about that, and I suppose when it was all over, or maybe even the midst of it in the news or something, of thinking, and my only thoughts at that point were, how can one little nation so quickly beat all these other little nations in a war, you know? One little, because I didn't have any really, you know, how central the Middle East was in that time, in our time as well, any of that kind of stuff. But I vaguely have that remembrance. But for, that was the time when Hitler came closest to winning. Somebody said that yesterday, giving a post, when did that come up? Does anybody remember? Posthumous victory to Hitler. Over what issue? What was that talking about?
Over worldwide militarism.
Oh, yeah, yeah, worldwide militarism. Well, 67 was for Jewish people. Well,
at that point, I was working with a Jewish lady.
You were?
And I remember almost overnight, the Jewish community raised something well over $1 million right in our immediate area to support this.
Mm-hmm. That really was. People were very conscious that Hitler was going to finally win. You know, I don't think that yet all the evidence is in on World War II, on the final solution. We tend to think, you know, World War II is over and done with. Jews don't feel that way at all to this day. And they certainly didn't in 67. That's why so quickly I suppose that they could raise $1 million. Well, part of me thinks that 1967... June of 1967 will be an important date for American Christianity. That's a little anticipating a whole lot, because right now it isn't. But part of me thinks that in the future it will, because that was the beginning, by the way, of the modern Jewish Christian dialogue. There had been some dialogues between Christians, even Lutherans, by the way, for those of you who are Lutherans and Jews before 67, but it was very isolated and not undertaken on any kind of planned out basis or with any kind of goals in mind or with any kind of, but in 1967 that changed everything. And what it did was it brought to remembrance again the Holocaust. Jews, for the most part, very few Jews did any kind of reflecting on the Holocaust. Now we know that there's a Holocaust center. Many big cities have Holocaust centers. Even Portland does. St. Louis does, I know. In Philadelphia, there's a Holocaust center for the kind of the headquarters of all the Holocaust centers. Reagan has appointed a Holocaust committee for Holocaust remembrances, and you know this last spring, I think it was, or this last, there was a, made lots of the newspapers, and maybe people from your own cities, Jews, went to Washington, survivors.
I was going to say there was a big one last year in Washington, and
right.
Also one of the buildings is going to be a Holocaust center. There's been a lot of paper in Washington.
Right. Well, none of that existed before 1967, really. There were really no Holocaust centers or studies. Survivors of Holocaust, it was just too close. Not until 1967 that it became even closer did people say, we've got to remember, we've got to start digging into this again, we've got to bring it to the attention of the world. And that's when there's kind of a, that's when Jewish people started thinking about the Holocaust theologically as well. What is, used the word meaning before, what is the meaning of the Holocaust from a Jewish perspective? And that's number two. I'm just kind of racing as I go along. We often deal with history by trying to find analogies, right? Think about the meaning of the Reformation. We try to find analogies, and we say Luther rediscovered the gospel, or the centrality of the gospel. So we find an analogy, and we say it's kind of one of the things that Paul did. You know, we look in the past to find an analogy. It's what the New Testament often did with when they reflected on what is this Jesus of Nazareth? What does that all mean? What does the crucifixion mean? That a Messiah is crucified. And so they look for analogies. And obviously they look to their own scriptures, the Hebrew scriptures, for analogies. And they found, if you think about the crucifixion, a crucified Messiah. What's an analogy? One analogy. Well, even that, okay. Okay, the Lamb of God. Well, you got Isaiah 53, a suffering servant. So it's kind of an analogy. And so you try to find analogies to help understand and to help give meaning to an event. Well, when Jews started in 67, and a few before that, but very, very few, started thinking about the Holocaust, and they tried to find analogies to it. They thought about, what about the analogy punishment for sin? They thought about that. They thought about the analogy suffering servant. They thought about, obviously a lot of these come out of their Hebrew scriptures. They thought about the analogy of martyrdom, and there's even a technical Jewish word for that, which I cannot remember. They thought about the analogy of divine powerlessness. Some of these, by the way, lots of Christians think about too when they think about Jesus or about what the Christian gospel of them. They think about the analogy of, how about some other ones? If you were a Jew and were thinking about in 1967, and all of a sudden you started to think about, this may be Hitler's victory. What kind of analogies would you look to try to make some sense out of this from a theological, religious point of view? How is God operating in the Holocaust? Huh?
Job thing.
Oh, yeah. The analogy of Job. How? Yeah. What about Job? Is it? Would be analogical.
The torment is just unceasing, regardless of their faith.
Oh, yeah. Undeserved suffering, maybe some people have called it that. How about some other analogies that you might think about? And you might try to, you work through to try to say, does this fit what's happened?
Would you try to work on the sacrificial lamb as millions dying on behalf of the world?
On behalf of the world. That's kind of the scapegoat analogy, by the way. That's where the scapegoat comes from. You know, you put all the sins of the world on the goat and you send it out into the wilderness to die. Interesting one. How about some other ones? Another one is divine. This is kind of the Job one. Divine testing, you know, testing in the wilderness and all that kind of stuff. The wandering in the wilderness. Well, there's all kinds of them. And for the most part, most Jewish theologians have said the problem with the Holocaust is none of the analogies really can capture it. And if you listen to them, if you read them, and if you attend lectures to people that are struggling with the analogies, it is amazing how analogies break down when it comes to the Holocaust. And you can you think of all these biblical analogies that we have, and there's just parts of it that the Holocaust seems to break the bounds of the analogy and to kind of say, no, that one can't make it. And some people have been saying, and that the Holocaust was an epoch-making event. It's beyond analogy. Because an epoch-making event is something that it defines reality from then on, or maybe even the past. But it's a definer, not something that can be defined with a past analogy. Analogies are always something in the past that define the present or define the future. Some events in history are so, some people use the word unique or overwhelming or unimaginable, that they define everything else, or at least they define huge portions of the world and of history. And people are saying, Jewish people, Christians too, I happen to think so too, that there's something about the magnitude and the dynamics of the Holocaust that make it an epoch-making. It makes a whole epoch, a whole era is defined by that. The Reformation defined a whole era. The Exodus defined a whole era. The exile, the Babylonian exile, defined a whole era. They were epoch-making events. And I think that Holocaust is an epoch-making event, not just for Jews, and not just for Jews and Christians, but for Western civilization, maybe more. So instead of looking for analogies, what a lot of people today are looking for, and this is one of the things that's involved in the present what's called Jewish-Christian dialogue, is a search. They've tested the analogies, and they seem to have broken down almost every one that somebody can come up with. Certainly there are parts of each analogy that are applicable. But to find a single analogy and to load it with meaning has been tough. Even the word Holocaust, that is an analogy. Yeah, that was a burnt offering. And it's probably the only analogy at this point that people are allowing, even though a lot of people say, well, we shouldn't be calling those years Holocaust, because it breaks that analogy. But that's the one that at least has stuck with it at this point. After testing analogies, in that period of testing analogies, there's kind of a new period, and it's a search, and it's a search for metaphors. Because what a metaphor does is it tries to bring together two previously unrelated meanings and to bring it into a single unit. And by bringing two previously unrelated meanings into a unit, it tends to raise the level of the meaning. So, for instance, um, Jesus was kind of a master at doing that in a lot of ways. Maybe the New Testament, but all it happens, it's kind of a common experience to create metaphors. When Jesus used the metaphor and used it as the prime metaphor to say, call God Father, to bring together two previously, at least for the most part, unrelated metaphors, or not common metaphor, and to bring them together, that blew everybody's mind. It was so shattering and so uncomprehensible that in the Gospel of John, people said, Jesus calls God his Father, and for that we will kill him. For us, that's kind of commonplace. And in fact, it's so commonplace that a lot of us like to protect it, myself included. My inside likes to protect it. It's hard to say anything but our Father who art in heaven. But we miss the earth-shatteringness of saying God is Father, because now that's a commonplace. A parallel to what Jesus would do is what some people are present-day proposing. It's a tough proposal to deal with. They call it, to say God and Mother and bring those two together. Or God, Father, Mother. Well, that's the feeling that you get if somebody would propose to say, Our Mother who art in heaven. That grinds on me too. But that if you can get in touch with that feeling, that's how people felt when Jesus said, Our Father who art in heaven. The same kind of grind on your, just the way you were brought up, the givens in your life. So metaphors try to up the ante of meaning by bringing together two things that haven't been brought together before, and to give it a new meaning that's greater than the two parts. Well,
Gary,
yeah.
I just have one question regarding the Holocaust. Did you say that analogy doesn't fit?
The word Holocaust.
The word Holocaust meaning burned off.
Yeah, well, a lot of people are struggling with that. You have to start calling something something. You can't just say the years between 1933 and 1945.
So it's functional as a historical term.
So, yeah. But, as long as, even that, if you become, I try not to call things to refer to it as the Holocaust. And leave out the article. I guess that's my own discipline to do that. Just call it Holocaust. Almost to give it some life. It's almost to make Holocaust a living, something living. That's almost a contradiction in terms. But anyway.
Just to say the Holocaust puts it in the past as if it would never be again.
Part of it. But also if you look at the phrase epoch-making event. Yeah, that's a present participle. It's something that it's continuing. It's a verb. It's a verbal phrase. It's something that creates. It creates a whole epoch, a whole time period in history. I personally think that Holocaust, Jewish Holocaust, is already and will continue to be that. I'll draw some. Try to draw some connecting links to that a little bit later. Anyway, there's a new search for metaphors. Some of the ones that have been being searched for. Metaphor takes imagination. If it's one thing that I think that Christians have some resources to do, is Christian imagination. The reason is because imagination takes freedom from all past, from the past. In order to imagine something, you have to have a certain freedom from the past, because imagination always has to do with the future. Imagining something that hasn't been imagined before, imagining something for which there is no analogy. Dan said something earlier, when you brought together king and suffering servant, Messiah and suffering Messiah. That was a metaphor that the New Testament used to talk about Jesus. And that was something new. Never talked about a suffering king. To bring those two together, Isaiah 53 and Psalm 2. Well, there's a search for that. Some of the ones that people are looking at right now are things called, Martin Buber used the term eclipse of God. Holocaust was the eclipse of God. There's going to be an eclipse. Oh, it was last week. No, it is. Well, it was last night.
It was during the day.
What's today? Wednesday? Thursday?
Friday.
It was Wednesday. Yeah, there was an eclipse. Solar eclipse. Well, if you think about what an eclipse is, Luther often referred to the hiddenness of God. Some people have tried to use that analogy. Well, Martin Buber calls it eclipse of God. Everybody's searching. Franklin Littell, a Christian, interesting one. It almost grates on you too, but I guess all of these new analogy or new metaphors always grate because they always take a given and turn it into a problem for the sake of a more godly solution. But part of what Christianity, what a Christian has resources, is to deal with things that grate with yourself. Christian freedom. Franklin Littell has offered this one. He calls it the crucifixion of the Jews. Interesting one. Obviously, he's picking up on our Lord's crucifixion. Turnabout one, too. A Jewish person called Michael Birnbaum has talked about the vision of the void. It's bringing together vision, which and a void, something that where there can be little vision. Vision of the void. Another man has used this one. A cloud of smoke and a pillar of fire. You know where that one comes from. It's kind of an Old Testament analogy, but it also comes from people who approached Birkenau or Auschwitz. And they saw clouds of smoke and pillars of fire. Well, there's all kinds of them. And part of the stage is in Jewish theology, a search for new metaphors. A man named Lawrence Langer has said something like this. One of the things that contributed Jews going to the gas chamber was the failure of an analogous past. Nobody could imagine. Nobody had that much. There was nothing analogous to what was happening. And if you read Elie Wiesel, Night, people were saying this. You know that people would come back. Few people would escape, and would come back and tell what was happening in the concentration camps. And the people just didn't believe them. They said that's impossible. Nobody in the 20th century could do that to human beings. And so they said that they were crazy.
How can it possibly be that people these days say that the Holocaust and these killings of millions of people was just a figment of imagination that has no basis? There are people that say that, and they can't understand it.
What would motivate somebody to say that? Somehow they have some interest in saying that, I suppose. A very strong social kind of interest.
They probably belonged to the Nazi party.
Well, frankly, they're Christians. Most of the people that are people that run the it's called the Center for Revisionism. Well, good questions. There's a million questions. Let me Lawrence Langer's thing. Contributing to the Jews going to the gas chamber was the failure of an analogous past and a failure to imagine the unimaginable future. In other words, they didn't have analogies and they couldn't imagine that happening. So they had a failure both of analogy and of imagination. Some people think all thinking is either analogy or imagination. So they just couldn't think about it. One of the things that Jewish theologians have been trying, I'm talking a lot right now about Jewish theologians, have been trying to do is how to locate God in the face of the Holocaust, Christian, or how to believe in God, or how can God be, in what way, what mode can God possibly be in the face of Holocaust? And I thought really talking at that point, I'd just read a few things. Well, before that, some people have said taking the option of atheism. Richard Rubenstein at the University of Florida, I think he still is. Just a lot of Jews have turned to atheism, Christians as well. Over the Holocaust, because of the Holocaust, what it has done to them. Some people have said, well, God can't possibly be involved in that kind of history, so God must be someplace in eternity. They didn't want to give up God totally, but at least they located God's activity and concern in eternity. Some people, anybody know of, heard of Viktor Frankl? He's a psychotherapist, and he tried to find a meaning. Lots of people, not just theologians, Jews, have been trying to find meaning in the Holocaust. And basically, he said, you know, the meaning of the Holocaust is kind of inside of you. You have to search. I think even his book is called Search for Meaning.
Man's Search for Meaning.
Man's Search for Meaning. And basically, he and many people, religious Jews as well, have turned inward and said, you know, God has got to be something inside of you. Can't possibly be involved in history in the way that many people have said. And others have said God is kind of involved socially. Community, but not in history. I don't know how they exactly separate that out. But a lot of Jewish people have said God has to be in history. Somehow we have to be able to reconcile God in history and have faith in God in history, even in the history of Holocaust. And here's how a few of them have tried to put it together. And I suppose that I have picked these people out because this is how I see it as well. And at least how I see it at this point. And I'll just kind of skip names because a lot of times they're it's kind of meaningless to talk about who they are. But Holocaust has put Western civilization on trial. An analogy. I'm moving down to number 3 already. Summoned to a cosmic trial. While this cosmic trial may seem self-evident to those who have reflected on the implications of the destruction of European Jewry, it is not self-evident. Western civilization, that's why it hasn't been dealt with, and why probably most of us, you know, we just haven't, you know, the Holocaust is not something we really think of, it's something past. Something that we're glad is over. Something that we didn't participate in for the most part. We didn't know about it when it was happening. Western civilization has suppressed and through passive aggression has refused to be put on the witness stand. Only the courageous persistence of the State of Israel, I'm going to get into that a little bit, has put Western civilization on the witness stand and compelled Western civilization to summon some transcendent or godly legitimation for its global hegemony. In other words, to justify itself. Like you would put a criminal on trial. However, Judaism and Israel have not taken part in this historically cosmic trial unreflectively, without profound, serious self-examination, all the examination of the different analogies. If there is to be a transcendent reference, that is, if God is to be involved in this history trial, as I think God has indeed been, continues to be, then Judaism will have to face the fact both that it has historically been the one who has insisted that God be and is present in history. Judaism has been the religion in the world that has said God is in history and refuses to be removed from history. And that Holocaust has called into question this very act of insistence on the part of Judaism. In other words, Judaism has had to ask the question, can we believe in God and history? Can we continue to proclaim that God is the God of history and historical events? So then I talked about one avenue could be atheism. Another avenue could be locating God in eternity or in nature, primarily, or in private inwardness. However, what they've come to conclusion as is, to choose any of these options is to leave God out of the history trial. And if you leave God out of the history trial, then in effect, you allow Western civilization to avoid taking the witness stand with any divine or transcendent seriousness. And these mistrial options, somehow leaving God out of them, would allow and almost encourage a Holocaust repeat to surface. Many of the Jewish theologians have said the state of Israel must be present because it is the only summoning eyewitness, victim, as the sole surviving, the state of Israel, as the sole surviving eyewitness, only the state of Israel simultaneously can challenge Western civilization to make its case in the presence of God and can implore God to make God's own case for God's role in Holocaust history. What they have agreed on is the state of Israel must be present for the trial. Well, a rabbi called Rabbi Akiba in the year 135, Common Era, CE, said something like this: if there is no judge, then there is no judgment. If there is to be judgment, then there must be a judge. And if there is to be justice, there must be a trial. How many of you were here this morning in Dan's Bible study? He used the story of, what's his name? The old Lutheran theologian who was traveling in Israel and his car broke down. And Joseph Sittler. And the guy fixed the carburetor, and the Israeli fixed the carburetor, and when he fixed it, he muttered and was overheard. He muttered, "Tzedek, righteousness." Well, if you use a metaphor that's in Scripture often a lot, in fact, it may not be a dominant metaphor in Scripture. There is no righteousness, no justice, without a trial. There must be trial. You could say, if you looked at that little story, you could say, well, that car was put under a trial, was cross-examined, and in the heat of the day, didn't make it. At least it hadn't been maintained well enough, or the oil changed, or... In some way, the car was... I hate to use this word. In some way, the car was guilty. And I suppose in that sense, I'm a little bit more... I'm kind of a conservative old Lutheran that believes in things like centrality of justification. But also on a greater level than just as individuals. Dan was talking about Thomas Jefferson, who cuts out his different Bible, you know, he has a Bible that's cut out. He leaves in what he wants to leave in. Well, we all do that. First of all, you have to come clean. Everybody does that. Everybody selects. Even if you know, literally your Bible has all the verses in it, the fact that I read Hebrews 10 and Matthew 5 and didn't read, you know, Leviticus, or the fact that, you know, we all select whether we literally scissors and pasted or figuratively or through our choice. We all select. And one of the nice things, nice disciplines about the liturgy is at least that much is given to us then. But then we get to select whether to preach on, you know, the gospel for the day or, right? But that is a certain amount of protection in that, and a salutary protection.
I'm feeling a little amused, I guess, to where you're getting at, how you're evolving this or whatever. And is this something that's actually going on, or is it something? Is it a theory that people are just interested in, or are there something in the sense of writing history, or
why is it important? What's the real life thing to it? Good question. I'm glad you brought that up, because it can be kind of, you know. Let me just read you something that was in the newspaper about 2 weeks ago. No, not less than that. May 24th. An editorial by the editor of the Oregonian, Portland newspaper. Religious harassment has been growing recently in Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. This bad seed sown in ignorant hate is watered by the tears of its victims. It needs to be rooted out with education and with vigilant public cooperation with police. The vicious incidents must not be downplayed as isolated or insignificant. Among the acts of the vandals in the past few weeks, and not just toward, almost all of these towards people who come out of Christian homes, mostly Protestant homes, probably. Two Molotov cocktails were thrown through a window of the Seattle Catholic Rectory, the residence of the Archbishop. There's threads, I think, in our country. Most of us don't know about the anti-Catholic things that went on for a century, literally over a century in our country. They were called nativism movements. Up to and including 1920. Who was around in 1920? Al Smith. Does anybody remember the campaign or know anything about the Al Smith campaign for presidency? Very anti.
That was after 1920.
After 20, yeah, it was 1920. It was Hoover, I think. Well, anyway. Anti-Catholic hate posters have appeared in several Oregon, Washington cities, often near Catholic churches. Posters claim, we just received something in the mail the other day, by the way, too. I think we need to draw some links between some of these kinds of things. What's happening with Jews, we ought not isolate. What's happened in the... one of the things I wanted to suggest about the Holocaust is that it's an epoch-making event. It's not over yet. All the evidence, kind of, so to speak, all the historical evidence hasn't been gathered up yet. Anti-Catholic hate posters have appeared in several Oregon and Washington cities, often near Catholic churches. The posters claim that the Vatican secretly owns and manipulates many newspapers, the three largest television networks, and major magazines as part of a plot to take over the governments of the world. Our church received this in the mail the other day. Big long thing. That is amazing. I know that it exists, but it still amazes me. Ahava Israel Synagogue in Boise was bombed April 29th. Boise's new Mormon temple was defaced with graffiti May 3rd. Anti-Catholic and anti-Semitic literature was stuffed in Salem mailboxes in recent weeks. Mormon temple in Idaho Falls was bombed early Saturday, May 19th. Now, these are all from the last couple of weeks. Swastikas were painted on the doors of Temple Beth Israel in Portland last week. I fear that we're unprepared, that we think just like people thought, that this can't possibly happen. It's only a minority. They're only isolated incidents. They're only done by teenagers, most of them, when they're caught. But the homes that they come out of, and the milieu of those homes. And I think that's part of, I guess, what, that's just one piece of strings that seem to come together. And one piece of that string is that Judaism has a grievance against both Western civilization and Christianity, because Christianity has been at least probably the major driving force in Western civilization. And if you suddenly remember, when bringing your gift to the altar, that a brother or sister has a grievance against you, leave your gift at the altar, and go quickly, reconcile, lest you have to pay every penny owed. That's the end of that little few verses. So in other words, it's incumbent upon us to reach out to those who have a grievance with us and to come clean with that. Anyway, that's part of, would be part of my answer to that. But you know, I struggle with the same things that those are the real life issues. You could talk about other ones. Many people have taught, maybe ideas affect how people live. You know, in other words, so what maybe an idea or a theory also has great influence on how people live. We live in a world that we think that the only way it can work is through managers, for instance. And some people have said one of the things that the Holocaust should be teaching us is what the philosophy of management is all about and where it can lead. Well, I don't want to get off on that one because that's another piece of Western civilization, particularly 20th century liberal Western civilization. So in one sense, they're just ideas. People are thinking about ideas. But let's take it a little step further on the state of Israel. How committed should we as mainline Christians be to the state of Israel? There's a kind of a formula going on today. Conservative fundamentalists, right-wing, moral majority, however you want to talk about them or however they want to talk about themselves, are very supportive of the state of Israel as a nation, but very anti-Judaism as a religion, while mainline National Council of Churches, or however you want to define them or have them define themselves, churches are very supportive, or at least open, to Judaism as a religion, and very much against Israel as a state, critical of Israel as a state. Interesting kind of paradox going on in our own country today, and there's some research just beginning on that, why those are. But for instance, the Six-Day War almost meant, you know, you can say it's an idea, but for people who live in Israel and for American Jews, it was enough to, as somebody said, you know, just for starters, they kicked in lots of money all of a sudden very quickly. I mean, those are real life issues for them. And they saw that as giving Hitler a victory. So while some of those are just, it's kind of it's a metaphor, a way to talk about things, like to say there is a cosmic trial going on, begun by Holocaust. The Holocaust was kind of the thing that summoned people to a trial.
But God is the judge of the trial, is that?
What people say is, I tend to think, if there is no transcendent judge, okay, then finally there will be no trial.
Okay, if God is the judge in the trial, then the state of Israel isn't beyond judgment.
And in fact, one of the things I talked about was their own self-criticism, their own coming clean. Right. It's a hot debate in Israel today and in American Jewish community. Just barely over half of the American Jews are supportive, and just barely over half of the Israeli Jews are supportive of present policies. But if you lend too much support to the self-criticism is always good, but when you take it away from yourself, it starts to becoming more like gossip.
I'm seeing more of a picture of God's judgment of the Western civilization, the Christian religions being on trial, with Israel being the victor, or Judaism being the victor. I'm misunderstanding.
Well, I think what people are saying is the state of Israel is the only witness to the crime.
the victim are as well.
Well, yeah, they're both victim and witness.
Yeah.
Like somebody who was murdered or well, that's what that's kind of one metaphor. But let me just wet our whistle a little bit for. That's my left hand. Lars, I'm just tracing hands right now. The left hand of Christology, what some people have been calling. What are the roots, the Christian roots of anti-Semitism? Or are there Christian roots? You know, we tend to think anti-Semitism is just, it's un-Christian. But are there some Christian roots to anti-Semitism? Some people have, this is a tough one. It's a tough one for me, and I'm not sure where I am on it.
Blaming the Jews for crucifying Christ?
Good question. How about, well, we could open it up to discussion about, what do you think are the things of, what do you think contribute to, what parts of, let's just call it Christianity, or Western civilization, what contributes to, what contributed to the Holocaust? What were the things that people took for granted, the givens? In their life.
Christianity is the only way. The only God we believe.
Maybe the Jews deserve punishment because they haven't accepted Christianity.
Well, that doesn't cost the Holocaust.
I'm asking for some. Why were the Jews singled out so highly, though? And why in the high point of Christianity, in the country that was, where Christianity was most prevalent?
Well, any Christian would be, no matter if he's Jew or not.
Would be what?
Somewhere, are they out of the country?
Every what? Every Christian?
In Nazi Germany, Hitler was the god.
Well,
the Christians who supported the Jews.
Pardon?
The Christians who supported the Jews.
Very few.
I think that's what she's
saying. Oh yeah, there were very few. Most Christians participated in the Holocaust. Yeah, a lot of times we say, what?
I'm just curious if that is fact or opinion. I mean, if most Christians at that point in that country participated in the Holocaust, because I haven't heard that either. I mean, my understanding was, as she's saying, that it was the Nazis who were...
Who did you think the Nazis were?
They were Christians.
I think the Christians participated just by their inaction.
Yeah, I think that's a matter of interpretation as to...
I think one of the things we realized, there were Christians, most of the Christians in Nazi Germany supported Hitler and supported Nazism, not realizing what an evil it was until afterwards.
Why didn't they realize?
Everyone wanted to disclaim it. Nobody wanted anything to do with Nazism or Hitler then. But at the time, they supported that whole thing. The book, line, and sinker.
I don't know how many of you have ever read Mein Kampf, or any of the things that have contributed religiously to, probably, you know, not many of us do. Here's one person. Things that contributed to Mein Kampf and to Hitler. And you, my dear gentlemen and friends who are pastors and preachers, I wish to remind very faithfully of your official duty, so that you too may warn your parishioners concerning their eternal harm, as you know how to do. namely that they be on their guard against the Jews and avoid them so far as possible. Let me just keep going for a few paragraphs. Especially you pastors who have Jews living in your midst. Persist. Remember, Hitler was a Catholic, even though, you know, probably most of us wouldn't consider him a Catholic. Brought up Catholic. Living in your midst. Persist in reminding the authorities to be mindful of their office and their obligation before God to force the Jews to work, to forbid them making money, to check their blasphemy and cursing. Just keep going. I'm picking and choosing a few choice things to read. I've read and heard many stories about the Jews which agree with this judgment of Christ. This person is writing is, namely, how they have poisoned wells, made assassinations, kidnapped children, as related before. I have heard that one Jew sent another Jew, and this by means of a Christian, a pot of blood, together with a barrel of wine, in which, when drunk, empty, a dead Jew was found. There were many other similar stories. For their kidnapping, the Jews' kidnapping of children, they have often been burned at the stake or banished, as already heard. This person talked about them earlier. I am well aware that they deny all of this. However, it all coincides with the judgment of Christ, which declares that they are venomous, bitter, vindictive, tricky serpents, assassins, children of the devil, who sting and work harm stealthily wherever they cannot do it openly. For this reason, I should like to see them where there are no Christians. I suppose back in Israel. Thus, if we ourselves do not wish to stand condemned by their sins, we cannot tolerate that the Jews publicly blaspheme and revile God the Father before our very ears by blaspheming and reviling Jesus. Wait a second. It gets worse. My advice, as I said earlier, he's recounting his advice earlier. First, that their synagogues be burned down, and that all who are able toss in sulfur and pitch. It would be good if someone could also throw in some hellfire. That would demonstrate to God our serious resolve and be evident to all the world that it was in ignorance that we tolerated such houses in the first place, in which the Jews have reviled God. Second, that all their books, prayer books, Talmudic writings, their entire Bible, be taken from them, not leaving them one leaf, and that these be preserved for those who may be converted. Third, that they be forbidden on pain of death to praise God, to give thanks, to pray, to teach publicly among us and in our country. Fourth, that they be forbidden to utter the name of God within our hearing. For we cannot with good conscience listen to this or tolerate it. But what will happen even if we do not burn down the Jews' synagogues and forbid them publicly to praise God, to pray, to teach, to utter God's name? They will still keep doing it in secret. If we know that they are doing this in secret, it is the same as if they were doing it publicly. For our knowledge of their secret doings and our toleration of them implies that they are not secret after all, and thus our conscience is encumbered with it before God. So let us beware. In my opinion, the problem must be resolved thus. If we wish to wash our hands of the Jews' blasphemy and not share in their guilt, we have to part company with them. They must be driven from our country. Let them think of their own fatherland. Then they need no longer wail and lie before God against us. One other quick section. I wish and I ask that our rulers, the people over us, who have Jewish subjects, exercise a sharp mercy towards these wretched people, as suggested above, to see whether this might not help, though it is doubtful. They must, that is, the government, the authorities, must act like a good physician who, when gangrene has set in, proceeds without mercy to cut, saw, and burn flesh, veins, bone, and marrow. Such a procedure must also be followed in this instance. Burn down their synagogues, forbid all that I enumerate earlier, force them to work and deal harshly with them, as Moses did in the wilderness, saying, slaying 3,000, lest the whole people perish. They surely do not know what they are doing. Moreover, as a people possessed, they do not wish to know it, hear it, or learn it. Therefore, it would be wrong to be merciful and confirm them in their conduct. If this does not help, we must drive them out like mad dogs, so that we do not become the partakers of their abominable blasphemy and all their other vices, and thus merit God's wrath and be damned with them. I have done my duty. Let everyone see to this, to his. I am exonerated.
you know, you could read page after page of that, of what part of the things that went in to what Hitler did. Who do you think might have written that? One of the things I believe in the communion of saints. We didn't get into the left-handed Christology at all, but I believe in the communion of saints, and that happens to be the most influential person in my life, one of them, at least, that wrote that. His name was Martin Luther. Things that he was recommending, and in fact, that most of them came true. There's lots of other things you can go. The big question today is: should there be a mission to the Jews? That's a toughie, and that'd be worth talking about for a long time. Anyway, I believe in coming clean. G2 equals P4. We better quit. Maybe we'll come back to that sometime. The second use of the gospel. So many things.
There's a large Jewish community in the Portland area.
I don't know if it's large or not.
On the other side of probably. Right?
Yeah, on the west side. On the west side of town. That's where all the synagogues are.
I wondered if you're in your ministry.
Well, I'm in a Jewish Christian dialogue right now, and just beginning. Chris, I'm kind of new in the area, so I don't know the people very well. It's a scary thing. I can hardly read that stuff from Luther without trembling.